This is a recording from the Kluge Roo Aboriginal Art Collection at the University of Virginia. On Friday, April 25th, the collection hosted a lecture by Kimberly Kristen, assistant professor at Washington State University. Kristen's talk is called A Safekeeping Place, Shifting Museum Spaces, and Embedded Aboriginal Cultural Protocols. She's introduced by Margot Smith, director of the Kluge Roo Collection.
So I just want to go then right to our speaker, and it's really funny because the way that I found out about Kim is through Austrade, and actually kind of through the computer, through a listserv of people who are interested in Aboriginal art, and specifically the group that I went to Australia with last summer. And we've all kept in contact and let each other know when things are coming up. And so someone in that group mentioned the Mukuru Archive, and I got right on the internet and looked up information about it, and that led me to Kim's blog and more information about her. Come to find out, she's a associate professor.
Assistant. Assistant. Well, you could give me tenure, though, so that makes my life a lot easier for the next 3 years.
At Washington State University, and has been doing this amazing project and has worked for a long period with the Aboriginal community at Tennant Creek, which is just north of Alice Springs, not too far. I stopped there on the bus one time on my way to Darwin. I've really never spent any time there. She's been, had continual engagement with the people in that community and worked with them in a lot of different programs. And it's kind of culminated in this really wonderful digital archive that she's going to tell you about. I'm not going to tell you a lot. But she's here tonight to talk about that and to talk about all of the cultural things that are part of building an archive like that with and for Aboriginal people. And so it's an amazing way to learn more about their culture because you have to find out all of the things that they want to do. So anyway, we're really pleased that Kim's here to share that with us. And just talking to her in the last couple of days, it's been like, it's really wonderful to talk with somebody who's had some of the experiences that you've had with Aboriginal people in kind of the same general area. And it's really nice to just hear the words and hear the, the cultural kind of parameters and just that understanding. I've really enjoyed every minute of talking to her. I know you'll enjoy this talk quite a bit. So I could say a lot of things about her. She's got a PhD from University of California at Santa Cruz. She received that in 2004. She published her dissertation, which is called Aboriginal Business: Alliances in a Remote Australian Town. And that in itself is interesting because she worked in a town, not one of these little communities that are all Aboriginal, but a town, a split of people, Aboriginal and non-Indigenous people. And that is forthcoming from the School of American Research Press, and several articles, and interestingly, too, a blog. So if you're looking at Will's blog, you might as well just get right into the blogs and go to Kim's blog, which is called Long Road, but it's www.kimberlykristen.com. So I know you'll have a lot of homework when you go and over the weekend checking up on these people online. But for now, just help me welcome Kim Kristen.
Second time I've been introduced by Margot today. She's fabulous at it. So it's been fabulous to be here. So I want to thank Margot especially for inviting me and flying me out here. And it's been wonderful. The talk I gave today on campus was really stimulating, and I'm looking forward to sharing all this with you all as well. So, like Margot said, I'm going to be talking about some of my work in Tennant Creek, and what I'm going to talk about is some innovative museum and archive projects that have been going on over the last few years. The title is A Safekeeping Place, Shifting Museum Spaces and Embedded Aboriginal Cultural Protocols. there'll just be a little quiz at the end, and you can... No. But before I jump right into that, I want to begin with a text. I'm sure you all... Did everybody get to see Fred? You're all so lucky. See, I wish I would have been here. But so, of course, we all know Fred is wonderful and amazing and has been doing this work. Was one of the reasons I went to Central Australia was, reading Fred's work as an undergraduate. So, you know, his book, Painting Culture, is really, right, it's a force to be reckoned with. I'm not going to try to reckon with it because, you know, he's done a great job. So I don't really want to talk about what's inside in terms of art. But what I want to stop on is something before we ever get into the pages about what's going on with Aboriginal art. And that's on page 6. And on page 6, there's a warning. It's not unheard of, but it's still a bit unusual, at least in the United States. You'll find this throughout Australia quite commonly. But what the warning says is, this book contains images and names of deceased people that may be sensitive to some Aboriginal communities in Central Australia. Please consult with knowledgeable local people before sharing it with members of the community. Now, this warning comes, you know, at least a decade after the first ethnographies in the Central Desert, but it comes at a moment today when there's an emergence of digital technologies, right? So that all of a sudden this ease of reproduction and circulation of texts and images, it brings with it both sort of promise and panic. There's sort of, it's hopeful. There's all these things that we can do so people around the world can see our work, but then there's a bit of panic, right? How are they going to do it? Who's going to see it? Who's going to get paid? Who's going to write? All of those things come up. So in part, Meyer's warning gestures to that, this new sort of digital era that we're in, right? But at the same time, it also indexes a particular strain of cultural sociality that's found throughout Indigenous Australia. And you might be familiar with this. Throughout Indigenous Australia, particularly in the Central Desert where I work, you will see in public spaces, if there are images of people who have died. This is from a cultural center in Australia. You'll find this is actual duct tape. So it's not really sort of delicate, and you know, if you work in a museum, it's not actually what you want to see. I've seen some, you know, interpretive or interior architects and stuff go a little bit mad over this stuff. But Aboriginal people will take. I've also seen cardboard, whiteout. You know, so if somebody has died and there's an image in a public space, it may be covered up. But it also happens in private spaces. So this is a photo of three wonderful Warramungu women that I started working with in 1995, recording their oral histories. And I gave this photo to some of their kin, and one of the things that people were doing at that time was laminating photos and then hanging them up in their homes. When I returned in 2006, the woman on the left had recently passed away. And I went into the home, and the photo was still there, but someone had taken an eraser and smudged out her face. And so tonight what I really want to discuss is this issue of cultural protocols, right? That goes around and intersects with the rise of Aboriginal cultural centers in Australia and also a renewed commitment on the part of museums to engage with Aboriginal communities. So at the same time you have a rise in Aboriginal cultural centers, you have museums being much more open to what those Aboriginal cultural protocols are. So specifically, like I said, I'm going to talk about my work with the Warramungu and these particular projects. So let's just jump right in. I'm sure you're all familiar with this. How many people have been to Australia? Okay, good. Anybody been to Tennant Creek? Yay! Oh, you've been to Tennant Creek? Oh, fabulous. Okay, we'll have to talk at the end. Okay, so just one night.
Yeah.
Did you stay at the Goldfields?
Yeah,
there's only two hotels. Okay, neither one of them are very good. But okay, so that's fabulous, though. I never get to meet people who know what I'm talking about. Okay, so if you look sort of almost dead center, that's really about where Tennant Creek is, 500 and some kilometers north of Alice Springs, 1,100 kilometers south of Darwin, sort of in the middle of nowhere. And so we can get a little bit closer view. There you go. That's the Northern Territory. Get a little bit closer there. That's Tennant Creek if we're sort of beginning, zooming in with Google Earth. And so you can kind of see there, right? So there's not much around it. You don't see much because there isn't anything really. It's a town of about 3,000 people, half of whom are Aboriginal. The other half are obviously non-Aboriginal, mostly white, although you have a few Asian and Islander people who are there today. It was founded in the 1930s as a gold town. So obviously the reason in all of this space of nothing, the reason there's a town, right, that white fellas built is because there was gold. You know, so, I mean, I think we can all imagine the colonial history. And so this is sort of the image that we get looking down from Google Earth that sort of starts to rough out, well, what is this place, Tennant Creek? If we look a little bit closer, the town unfolds a little bit more, right? So we start to see street signs, Ambrose, Schmidt, Leichhardt, all named for miners or explorers who came through the town. Okay, and the yellow is the North-South Highway, the Stuart Highway, named for John McDowell Stuart, who opened the center of Australia in the mid-1860s. So the coast had been settled in the 1700s, the flag raised in 1778 in Sydney Harbor. It took over 100 years to get into the center, and explorers kept dying. There's just fabulous stories about these explorers, Burke and Wills and these other guys who kept trying to get out there and just kept dying. And they originally thought there must be a land sea in the middle of Australia, because they thought there has to be, right? There has to be water, or how else? Well, obviously there's not. But, you know, so that theory didn't pan out. But so the Stuart Highway is another track to mark the sort of non-Aboriginal spaces in town. And then you can see the ones marked in green, the Tennant Creek Recreation Reserve, you know, all the things of a sort of normal Australian non-Aboriginal town. But what we don't see on this map, even with the granularity that you can get on Google Earth, which is quite amazing, I mean, that you can see this much of Tennant Creek, even with that, what we don't see are the tracks of the Warramungu, or the tracks of the Warramungu ancestors. So if we sort of retrain our eye and we look with a different angle, if we look from a different social cultural lens, if we look at this as Pata, what the Warramungu people call Pata, or hard ground country, then we get a little bit different view. We start to see the Mungamunga women who traveled by the hundreds across the land, or the Ninka who tangled with the crow as he made his way out of town, teaching people how to sing the land into being. We might see Jala Jirpa, the white cocky, who went along meeting at these different water holes and moving out towards town, teaching people how to hunt, teaching them language. Or Pitangu, the flying fox, as he tangled with the crow and moved north out of town to a site called Kunjara. Or we might see up near the top, the yellow dot there, Junkaragu, a water hole where the black snake lives today, and where men and women still perform ceremonies that they call ritual business. Or the yellow dot in the middle is where the Ninka went back into the land and resides today. And the three water holes up towards the right, Jara, Jakara, Bingamanda, where the flying fox and the white cocky tangled and left their remains along the way, taught people how to hunt, taught women certain ceremonies, and then made their way along. So it's these tracks, these overlapping tracks, not the first map or the second map, but both maps, that we need to really understand. It's the overlapping tracks of settlers, miners, Aboriginal ancestors, and Aboriginal people today that give us a really richly layered landscape. And so when we think about the emergence of cultural centers or the rise of tourism, of cultural tourism, we have to grapple with both of these because it comes out of both. We usually only imagine the first. I'm sort of suggesting that we need to look at both of these together to see how tracks are extended and they're forged. Ancestral tracks don't end. They are continually remade and forged. So if we take a look here, we start to see the home of the Ninka. There's the site that I was talking about. So those are the black rocks that are the home of the Ninka, where the Ninka endures today. To the north of that is the primary school. Right to the south is a mobile station. And then right on the western side is the Stuart Highway. So in amongst all of this, it's quite astounding that through to the mid-1990s, this site remained untouched. So the home of the Ninka was right there. Had the Stuart Highway been built, you know, a kilometer or so to the west, this site would have been destroyed. So I think it's quite astounding that Warmongoo people chose this site in the 1990s as the place for a cultural center, right? So choosing this place as the most appropriate venue, and here you can see it today, really speaks to that national and global rise of indigenous tourism, as well as the increased dialogue between national museums and Aboriginal communities. For it even to be imagined, for people even to think, we want a cultural center, that dialogue was already happening. The possibilities opened up by Ninkanunu is that we can reroute some of those entrenched tracks that have so fervently tried to wipe out those other tracks of Warmongoo people and Warmongoo ancestors. So the center really stands as a testament to these two coming together. So together, right, local community members, outside contractors, researchers such as myself, National Museum staff, all worked really collaborative. It started actually in 1995, the first year I went to Tennant Creek, was the first meeting, because the site had just, they just got the site back. And it was completed in 2003. And so it spanned quite a bit of time because of all the processes of negotiation, both internally that the community needed to go through, how are we going to represent ourselves to others, as well as obviously fundraising and those kind of things. But the center itself really tries to replace Warmongoo history and cultural protocols and artifacts and social structures back into that national landscape. And so the goals that the community had really from the beginning were multivalent. It wasn't ever just going to be one thing. And we get sort of a sense of this from the actual physical layout of the center. So on the right you see there, that's the shop. So as soon as you go into Ninkanunu, you're in the shop. So obviously we know, since you guys have had all these great talks here, that Aboriginal people in Australia, like Indigenous people around the world, end up being the most poor. And so a development like this certainly was aimed at some sort of gaining some sort of economic stability, right? Getting the tourists who are going to come along the track, if you're going to be along the Stuart Highway, you do have a way, you know, to do that. And so that was the shop. Then if you go to the left, and you can kind of see that door over there, you go into the museum and gallery space. And I'm going to talk about what's in that museum and gallery space. And then on the right here, which isn't actually on the right, but it's back behind that wall, behind a wall, because it's the community center. So people really did want a place to educate tourists and let tourists know about Warmongoo people and culture. They also wanted a place for themselves. And obviously, that's born out of their history of dispossession and attempted assimilation, etc. But it was really important that there was both. Right? And so the tourist space had a pretty well-defined agenda to make money. The community center had still a little bit fuzzy, but still pretty well. People knew they wanted to have their own projects, educate children, language classes, things like that. But this middle space, the museum space, was less well imagined. People had to decide what it is that they wanted to be there. Out of that social landscape that I just described, they were trying to figure out how do we represent ourselves. It had to be a really conscious process of thinking about representation. And how were they going to repackage or reframe, right, all these Warmongoo cultures and traditions into something that would be recognizable to themselves and then recognizable to other people. Now, so one of the most exciting projects that came out of that middle space when they're thinking the planning for Ninkanunu was the creation of 16 prints to describe the Puntu system, and that's the skin system. Are people familiar with the skins a little bit. Okay. Sorry, I think you have to raise your hand like you're in my class, but habit of teaching. there's 16 skins, so it's a moiety. So there's two halves to the community, right? And though within each of those, so there's 16 total skins. So everybody's born with a skin. Your mother has one, your father has another. You come out of that with one skin, and it relates you to people in very specific ways. So we see here, right? So Namagili marries Jungli, and their children are Numbin and Jumbin. Okay, and you go down the line. All the N's women, all the J's are men. So it's a very specific system that relates people to each other in very specific ways. But it doesn't just define relationships in terms of bloodlines. It also is a system that designates the proper ways of acting and interacting, not just with people, but with the physical landscape and with ancestors as well. So Michael Jumbin, who's a elder in the community, put it this way. We Aboriginal people show respect to each other. Wingara, the dreaming, gave us skin names for people, soakages, hills, trees, stars, water, animals, for everything in this country. We don't cut trees in another person's country without permission, or take water, dig the ground, or split rocks. People have different ways of showing respect to different relations. We avoid people after taking part in initiation ceremonies together. We show respect to our in-laws and don't talk directly to them. We act modestly towards our elders, fathers, mothers, and grandparents. So Jumbin's words really remind us that the skin system is a dynamic system. It's not just about who you're related to because of who you're married. It functions as a way to remind people every day how to act, how to interact with them, with other people, with the landscape, with these other than human ancestors. It's the very basis for a social system, right? It's that baseline thing for continuing relationships into the future, not just something static in the past. So as part of Ninkanunu's sort of charter to educate visitors, right, this notion of kinship was pretty basic, right, throughout Aboriginal Australia, and everybody sort of thought, yes, we have to explain this to those tourists that come through. They're going to want to know about this. They'll probably have some idea anyway, so we need to think about this. So the first thing that I did was get the Warramungu Land Claims handbook and from the 1980s and 90s and pulled it out, and we were looking at the genealogical charts and whatnot. And it was really sort of frustrating to people. Now, even this anthropology 101, so normally in anthropology you have triangles and circles, right, that display kinship systems. Here you've got it updated and you've got sort of little people and you trace it that way. But this left people dissatisfied. It's flat, it's mute, it's static lines, they're very generic. They don't represent that vibrant, lived social system that I just talked about, that wonderful map and all that interaction and those beautiful words that Jumbin wrote. You know, this was sort of, and everybody was sort of, you know, well, okay, what can we do? This is what you white fellas have come up with. We could probably come up with something better. We don't even understand what this is. So, you know, what is it that you're trying to do? So we were very, very lucky that Alison Alder was the visual arts coordinator for Ninkanunu at the time. She also happened to be the former manager of Jalalakari Arts. Now, Jalalakari Arts is an Aboriginal women's arts center that was started in 1993 when a group of Warramungu women approached Jalalakari Council Aboriginal Corporation, which is sort of the umbrella corporation, approached them to create a women's arts center. The women really wanted a place of their own, and I recently spoke with Allison, and she said, quote, "The women all said that they wanted to learn new skills, to learn how to do lots of things, painting, printing, batik, leatherwork, pottery. They wanted a place of their own, somewhere safe and comfortable, and also where young women could go. So Alder was hired in those early days to sort of help with the planning of it. This was before they had any space. The women started out just in a bow shed behind Jalal Akari. But over the years, after, you know, sort of 1994, when they actually became Jalal Akari Arts, up to today, so over the last 14 years, they've got federal funding and NT funding, and they've moved into a building at the north end of town. You can kind of see that outdoor space, and this is all from the north end of town, in a building that's locally known as the Pink Palace. And so you see the car hood, or they call them bonnets in Australia, that are painted with the signature pink of the Pink Palace. And a rotating group of women have worked at Jalal Akari over the last 14 years, some of them for 5 and 10 years. They really have actually quite a few women who've been there a long time. And I think a lot of that is testament to the wonderful managers that they've had, who really empowered the women to feel like this was their own place and they could do what they want. The Jalal Akari has also, as you can see from just a little bit of a glimpse of these few paintings, has also made quite a name for itself. One national arts organization called the work in Tennant Creek, quote, an emerging Tennant Creek style, bold, strong, and fresh. You can see here a few of the paintings. And you can see why they call it bold, strong, and fresh, I think. The women have been sort of genre busting in that they've never felt confined by any sort of predetermined notion of Aboriginal art. They paint their country in ways that shows the interaction of their lives with other people, with tourists, teachers, shop owners, and visiting artists. A part of this is because they live in a town that's, you know, and that's always been this sort of overlap. And so they have a style that really sort of defies any easy classification. Most notably, their bright and bold colors and the relatively few dots that you'll see in their paintings. There certainly are, but you will see relatively few. Most notably, a lot of their success has been driven by the work of Peggy Napanardi Jones. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with Jones, but she's had several dozen successful national shows that have sold out, and she's beginning to be recognized internationally as well. Peggy was really the first one. She was one of the first women that Allison worked with, and Allison said she just immediately, this is what she started painting. She did, there were, you know, she didn't go, it was just as if she, this is what she had in her mind, and this is what she was going to do. It was like that from the beginning. There was no training, and Peggy, I think, is now in her mid-60s, and this was so about 10 years ago. She just picked up a brush, and this is what she came out with. And so, and this set the tone for the rest of the women. Again, she paints her country with these just enormous, enormous images that you can't help but be drawn to. This is the four cockies. So again, that white cocky, one of the dreaming ancestors, and the tracks that are part of her country. She paints a lot of these. She also paints a lot of soakages, again, from her country. So the focus is still her country, like you're going to find in all of this art that you see here, and you're probably more familiar with, but it's a different mode of representing that country. There's these large figures really command attention, and I think they ask us to see country in a different way. One of the commentators at her first solo sold-out exhibition in Melbourne said, quote, Jones had broken the dot barrier. Obviously referencing the lack of that most recognizable signifier of Aboriginal art. And, you know, so there's a lot of argument. You know, what makes Aboriginal art? Is you're Aboriginal and you paint, is it Aboriginal art, or is it something else? And Peggy's work really pushes that boundaries. I mean, I don't think anybody would say it's not Aboriginal art, but she, you know, particularly when so much of what you see is the dot painting, she really kind of pushed those bounds. And she's been an inspiration for other women, younger women, to come to the center and just, as Allison says, give it a go. And, you know, again, Allison, a wonderful manager there, and their current manager, Alan Mern, again, the same. You know, the women feel really safe and secure to try new things. Most recently, Lindy Brody. Lindy's in her mid-30s, And she so has lived, grew up in the 1970s, 1980s, and so has a particular view of country. She tells her stories of her country mainly through issues of contact. So you see here the old Fruina turnoff. That's a turnoff. It's just a turnoff on the Barkley Highway. You're going to drive by it if you're going down the Barkley Highway. She animates it here with these bright cars, with the cattle station in the back, because she lived on that cattle station. That was both a place where her and her relatives work, where she went to school, but it also overlapped with her ancestral country. So you'll find this a lot through the Northern Territory in that, unlike some other parts of Australia, even though people were moved from their lands and went to cattle stations and missions, they were a lot of times on their ancestral country. So they were able to maintain language, still do their ceremonies. Most of the men in Tennant Creek, over 50 who worked on cattle stations, because unlike women, they were able to travel because they were droving cattle. And so they were really able to keep up their ceremonies. And in fact, they kind of look at it with nostalgia as opposed to now when they're more bound by town. But, so you can see Brody's work is really alive with her connections that she feels to country, through both the self-determination politics that she grew up with in the 1970s, as well as her life in this outback gold mining town. And pastoralism was another big part of that. So she really asks Australians to look at the frontier differently. This isn't a frontier that was settled and Aboriginal people were moved away. This is a frontier where you were mixing, you were both together. So again, layering those tracks one over the other. So all of this stuff that was coming out of Jalalakari Arts and that Alison Alder had been part of really was sort of inspirational for that Puntu system. So getting back to that, remember, how are we going to display this? We're not going to use those ugly old anthropological kinship charts. And so this work coming out of here was really sort of an inspiration. And it was an inspiration not just because it was a contemporary style, but because it showed the contemporary nature of Aboriginal people today. We're living today, right? We're here, we're doing stuff, and we want to be seen that way. And that's what everybody said. We want tourists to come in and talk to us and ask us about our lives, not just, the dream time. Obviously, that's important, but hello, we're standing right in front of you, right? And so the final set of 16 portraits, one for each skin, were produced by Warmungu community members, very few of whom would call themselves artists. Alison Alder and the other women really encouraged everybody to get involved in this process. In fact, one of the goals by the Warmungu elders who started Ninkanunu was get the young people involved. They knew Ninkanunu was going to be their legacy, right? They worked hard through the 70s and 80s to fight the government and reclaim their land. Ninkanunu was going to be for the next generation. If these younger kids weren't involved, it wasn't going to happen. And so the way people chose to represent themselves really shows the diversity of the Aboriginal population in Tennant Creek. Sort of gives us a glimpse into how people see themselves. They were painting self-portraits, by and large. There's a few that people painted of other people, but they're mostly self-portraits. So it kind of shows how people were imagining themselves as well as their relationships to other people. So you sort of get a sense of this on the accompanying text. So this is, this was painted by Rose Graham, who's Djungare's brother. But so it gives you, right, Djungare is brother for Namagili. And so as you pass by the set of 16 that are hung on the wall in the gallery space in Ninkanunu, you sort of see Djungare there, and he's ready to head out for a night on the town. That's what Rose told me. That was him all dressed up, and yes, that is Djungare there all dressed up. Or Napananga's children would be Naralu and Juparula, Namagili and Djungare. So again, we get a sense of this sort of, not just, these images, but how are people related to each other. And if we look sort of closely at the images, we can also see the overlapping histories and the extension of those histories. So Juparula down in the corner in his favorite Jimi Hendrix t-shirt. Or again, Namagili's painting of Djungare. We see cowboy hats and baseball hats, dangling earrings and reggae t-shirts. And then there's down here in the corner, Jumbin's rendering of himself in his stockman's gear. Now, Jumbin's portrait is particularly striking to me. One, because I've worked quite closely with Jumbin over the last 10 years and doing some oral histories. But also, you know, his portrait, let's look at it closer. His portrait is really telling to me, I think, even if you don't know him. It's a juxtaposition of the white frontier cattle industry, right, that was aimed at settling Aboriginal people and settling the country. But we don't see that here. We see this bright, bold depiction of himself as this cowboy, right? So we have him not settling the country, but maintaining the country. In his articulation, both as a stockman and a traditional Aboriginal man, he was both. You cannot deny either, right? So as he was moving along those stock routes, he was forging his own routes through that country, maintaining the connections with his ancestors. Now, like I said, you know, Jumbin recalls these days with a lot of nostalgia. And when I was there in 2006, I asked him about this, and he said, "This portrait that I done, this came to my memories about my early late 50s, I think, when I was 1950s, when I was a young fella. I grew up in a big cattle station, which is Rockhampton Downs in the Barkly Tableland. I spent all of my time when I was young just doing that stock work since I was 14. So it just reminded me of that and how I used to work, and that's the picture on this rail with the saddle hanging." And Jumbin really likes to remember those times, and he talks about them frequently. And so we get sort of a sense when we look at all of these. Go back to here, right? Taken together, the 16 self-portraits really create the basis for rereading kinship, relations of respect, and histories of contact in ways that defy historical narratives of separate pasts or current visions that relegate Aboriginal life to misery and despair and a flawed future. Right? That's what we get out of the intervention. You Aboriginal people don't know what you're doing. You're living in squalor. We have to help you. Here, we see the reality of interdependent futures. Right? So people coming together, forged in spite of and from the tragedy of loss and dispossession. These prints refuse to separate everyday experiences and life histories from the structures of kinship and community. Work and play, loss, hope, all of that shape the relationships and the bonds that one has. It invites the viewer to imagine a different scenario, to see something new, right? It's not downplaying the problems with the community, but the center and its displays are a testament to another vision, not just the past, but also the future. And so this display, along with another set of 10 dioramas that go along with defining Warramungu history and their country, really work together to push viewers, when they come into the center, to look at Aboriginal people and Aboriginality and that country again. Let me just take us quickly through the dioramas, or what's locally known as bush TVs. So if you know anything about Central Australia, you throw the word bush in front of anything, and you know it's rustic and remote, and you know it speaks of Aboriginality. But here what happened is, so this is a set of 10 dioramas. So the kinship display was decided upon. And then people went through themes. How are we going to come up with some themes of things that we want people to learn about? So it started off with about 19 or 20 and got whittled down to about 10 of these dioramas. And they tell their stories through these sort of layered images. And the finished dioramas, they have everything from the stolen generation to one on mining and one on ceremonies, one on the pastoral industry. So a whole mix. One on the night patrol, which night patrols are the community organizations that today go through town picking up people who have had too much to drink, and so they don't end up in jail. So you can see here a couple of the dioramas. The top one here, Jinkragu, again, tells the story of this place through a layered history. On the sides of all the dioramas are archival documents. In the back and or on the other sides are photos and images from the present day. And then in the foreground are these stick figures that were wonderfully made by people in the community. Went out and cut Calcardi bushes and then took Spinifex resin to fasten these. Or the little cows were made out of leather. I mean, it was a great process that we went through to think about these histories. And so here you have Jinkragu, the place I told you about that's really significant to Warmongu people, and the Pioneer Theater, right? That was downtown. So you get this juxtaposition of tradition and modern all in one.
What's the scale?
I don't know. They're about like that. Yeah, sorry, I don't know the exact. But creating these dioramas was really a lengthy process. So it included, we had to do research in the archives to get these sort of what people called paper histories, right? So the histories that white fellows had, as well as then talking with elders, so going around and doing these oral histories, and then also traveling to museums and other places to create this sort of layered history. So in 2002, we took trips to the South Australian Museum, the Museum of Victoria, and you can see here many of the artifacts. There are thousands of artifacts in the South Australian Museum, many of which have been repatriated on a rotating basis to the center. But so we went down, and there were just trays and trays and trays and boxes that the curators were pulling out. Later that year, in April, I accompanied a group of Warmongu people to the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory. But as we walked through those storerooms, everybody was really very disappointed. After those fruitful trips down south where we saw thousands, there were actually only 3 artifacts that we found that were for sure had come from Tennant Creek. The old men and women there that looked at the images, there were none, or looked at the artifacts, there was nothing else that came. There were some things that had been anonymously donated in the 70s, but people didn't even think those were from Tennant Creek. And so, we were somewhat dejected. We took 2 days to drive, 1,100 kilometers. It's just, and people were sort of, and so we had, the next day we went to the archives, and we ended up coming out of the archives with about 700 pages of documents that related to people's lives. Everything from when kids were taken away to missions, to how much they were paid on the cattle stations, every part of Aboriginal people's lives were really cataloged during that time of protectionism and assimilation, And then on the drive back, one of the women said, that one missionary that used to live in Tennant Creek? They just live outside of Darwin. Why don't we ring them up and we'll just stop and have tea? So, fine. Okay, let's do that. Let's stop and have tea. So we did, and we explained to them why we were in Darwin and that we were doing this big project for Ninkanunu. And they said, come back here. And we went into the back room, and I'm not kidding you. Boxes and boxes and boxes of photos. Just dozens of boxes with hundreds and hundreds of photos. And the gentleman, the former missionary, he had already scanned about 500 to 600 of those. So for the next 2 hours, we loaded those onto my laptop, and we left Darwin with about 500 images on my old black Macintosh. And so what happened then, these photos and those digital documents, or the archival documents, etc., became sort of the catalyst for another project. Something that I've been thinking of in terms of virtual repatriation. So, right, you had that physical repatriation from the museums. What we had here now was a whole different set of images that were being given back to the community digitally. And after that first set, people started calling every missionary, school teacher, and researcher that had ever been to Tennant Creek, and so all of a sudden, the stacks of CDs were piling up, right? And so I was doing iPhoto slideshows on my computer, but people really, you know, then people, as they were looking, they'd sort of look at the photos, and if it was one they weren't supposed to see, they'd sort of back out, you know. Everybody knew, as they were viewing the images, who should see what and how they should see it, right? That was part of these Waramungu cultural protocols. Now, the protocols have this sort of structure. That is, in English, Waramungu people will say an image or an artifact or something that you're asking them about, some ritual knowledge, they'll say, oh, that's open or that's closed. So it seems like this really rigid system, right, a binary. It's either open or it's closed. But as I think many of you know quite well, and from what we've been talking about tonight, there's a lot of different elements that go into making up openness or closure. You have gender, ritual affiliations, family relations, the death of a kin, ancestral relations, or your country connections. So each of these combine in all these different variable ways to produce a continuum of openness and closure. Very rarely is anything either just open or totally close, right? So an elder might pass away, and so things will be covered up for a while, but then they'll come back, or the knowledge associated with that elder will go away for a while, then it'll be redreamed, and it will come back. Or, you know, a song series might be only for women, so women hear it and women sing it, even within that subset of women, right? It could be for a specific country. So we had all these scenarios. There's all these scenarios, but what's most notable about this is it's really a dynamic system. It's something that's continually changing and negotiated by the people themselves. So what we needed to do then was take this dynamic system that already exists and make this into a digital archive that people could use to view all. We needed a filter, right? So we need to take this system, pop it into, you know, get some smart computer programmers and make this work. Luckily, I happened to find a couple smart computer programmers. I'm not a computer programmer. I'm obviously an anthropologist. However, one of the things I did do is find some wonderful technical help. And over about 2.5 years of, you know, community consultations, flying back and forth, and, you know, different demos and working with the community, we came up with what we had just installed in August of 2007. And that's the Mukuru Wumpurani Kari Archive. Now, this digital archive gives Waramungu people the control to dictate the terms of access and circulation of all those images through this interface that we came up with. So I just want to sort of walk you through that so you can get a sense of what it's like. So what we needed to do, right, we had all the content, we know this dynamic social system, we needed to marry the two. So the first thing was tagging the content. So you get the images uploaded, and it's quite easy to upload the images. Once they're in, then we needed to get the metadata in there. The metadata is just information about them. So we have the sort of standard archival information that you would get, you know, the image, the file name, that type of thing. But then we had what's important to the community. So everybody has their first name, last name, and skin, as well as a little box to check if they're deceased. And I'll show you a warning image later that comes up if they're deceased. You also have a place here for the country, so which countries are represented, which families are represented. So here you might have 4 or 5 different families, right, that are in this photo and at one particular place. Because this is a song and a dance, you have a drop down for song and dance. So you're going to say what the song is, what the dance is, who was singing, who is all of that vital information that's left out of those archives in Darwin, right, because nobody knew that information. And then over here, what's significant is this is where community members tell their story. So instead of, you know, the anthropologists and the archaeologists telling what they think this is, the people themselves get the ownership to narrate their community history, their rituals, their songs, etc. So once you've done all that, the next thing is to determine the sharing protocols. That's the terminology we sort of came up with. So you can either set it as open. So there is a public aspect of the archive that eventually, not today, but eventually they're hoping to make it part of the tourist part. So those are things that people are happy to let tourists and other people see. But that 90% of the content in the archive falls under this second thing, set restrictions. So here again, is it for men only or women only? Is it sacred? So that means it's for elders only. Again, people that belong to what country? So in the previous one, you told what country that was. So maybe that was Kunjara that we were looking at. Here, people from what country can view Kunjara? So what sets of people who are related to that can see that? And then which families are allowed to see that? And then you can do, and that's any permutation. So you could mark, you know, women, Kunjara, men, you know, so you can do all sorts of permutations of that to get that dynamic sense. You can also go back at any time and edit this. So, right, cultural protocols change because this is a dynamic cultural tradition. These people aren't static. They're going to change as well. So you can go back and change this quite easily. So this is this four-step process that you go through for everything that's loaded into the archive. So it's a quite lengthy process, but people are quite happy to do it. It brings about stories and whatnot. So now we've got everything in the archive and we've got it tagged. How do we get people linked to that in the right way? So what we came up with is this extensive user profile. So first, people put in their individual information, first name, last name, their skin name, gender, community status, are they children, elders, you know. So if they're marked elder, then anything that's marked sacred, they'll be able to see. So that's their individual standing and how they're related to the content. But as we know, there's also their community relationships, right? You're never just related to something individually. So you have your father's country, your father's family, your mother's family. So those relationships that are important offline in everyday life are in here in this user profile. The profile links you then to every piece of content, right? So you have a profile that says you're a woman related to these families and these countries. Then every piece of content is tagged, right? So it has this country, this, right, gender, etc. So when you log in, you get this mini archive of maybe there's out of the 1,500 things in the archive, your permutation gives you, let's say, 200, right? So you're guaranteed that you can look at all of this stuff. You don't have to filter through file folders or anything. You can view this. And then people wanted a way to search by their own cultural categories. So you can browse by country, family, songs and dance, art and artifacts, Bush Tucker, Bush medicine. So again, we took the cultural categories, the way people already think about these objects and things, and embedded those in the archive. And then on the right hand or on the left hand side, then if you don't want to browse, you can browse, and then again you'll just get another sort of filter. If not, you just go ahead and click on an image. Now here's what you'll get. Remember, if we put in the names and somebody was deceased, you'll get this warning. And this was an adaptation, because normally people will say, well, we don't look at images of people who have died, right? This is changing. And so we came up with this. The first iteration of the archive that we had just had everything closed off, and people said, we actually want, you know, some people might want to see some of them. So this pop-up warning was we see these all the time. This was a great way of dealing with that dynamic cultural system, right? It's changing, and luckily the technology allows for that. So if you want to see it, then you go ahead and look at the image, and you'll see then people can add their own comments. So here again, the first person that puts it in, who it belongs to, or who has access to it, will write the first story. Then everybody else gets to narrate it. So you get this really great layered history, particularly wonderful for indigenous communities in Central Australia who have been sort of torn apart by government policies and parts of the stolen generation. So you get people adding in these sort of layered histories. And from here, people can also print or burn a CD, so there's a lot of ways. So this really expands the curatorial process. Normally, that curation is handled by somewhere else, somebody outside of the community. It could be even in consultation. This hands the curatorial process over to the community. And again, Michael Jumbin summarized it this way. Mukadu is that dilly bag. The way that Warramungu people use it, they used to have them old dilly bags in them early days. Old people keep their stuff in that bag, and no one else was allowed to open it or even to look at it. Now we have this archive. It's good. In every archive that you go to, there's a lot of stuff that's in a safe place. in South Australia and Queensland. But this archive will be different. It will be here. It will be the safe place for man like me. I can't see women's stories, or even if she is my daughter or niece, I'm not allowed to see. So it won't open up for me because we have different passwords. This is very important to make it safe. So this emphasis on safety, right? For a previous generation, the dilly bag was that layer of protection. Mukadu means dilly bag, literally. The translation today for mukadu is safe keeping place. So in previous generations, you had the dilly bag, right? But it wasn't like you put stuff in there and it never got taken out. The keeper of the bag had the responsibility to open up that knowledge, to open up that object, to circulate it throughout the community, to perform it, to have people, to keep that knowledge going. The only way you're going to keep that is to keep it going. And so I think, for me, Ninkanunu, as well as the archive, is really part of a new dialogue between museums and technologists and indigenous communities that expand these sort of archival spaces and give us this new way to animate this territory of museums and archives. And Howard Morphy says it this way. Museums become sites of persuasion that people attempt to use to get their vision, their version of history, and their regime of value acknowledged and disseminated to wider audiences. Indigenous societies have to use the very institutions that created earlier interpretations to change the climate of opinion about their way of life. Right, so using the very institution to shift and relayer and put those maps back together. Now, the traditional National Museum that was inaugurated in sort of imperial dreams, right? The museum was really a national entity to remind people, you know, how they were supposed to be and how the nation came into being. That, over the last 20 or 30 years, has started to fade. And it's given way to these more open, collaborative projects and spaces. And I think that Aboriginal cultural centers like Ninkanunu really have a special place in this expanded museum landscape. As tourist destinations, galleries, and community centers, they really remap and refocus exhibitions and display making and infuse the process with these claims to both a historical past and a future. And so I think that the Mukadu Wumpurani Kari Archive is one example of the way in which cultural protocols can work as points of collaboration between national museums and archives and Aboriginal cultural centers, aiding in this process of virtual repatriation. And in doing so, hopefully, opening up a new type of dialogue between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in the nation as well. I think Aboriginal cultural centers have much to offer in the way of an expanded view of a museum space and the lives they seek to represent through new collaborations and new productions. Like the Puntu displays and the diorama, the archive embeds Aboriginal protocols and stories and social systems in the museum space, thus altering that space. I think museum spaces can take their cue from Aboriginal cultural centers and from the Mukadu Archive to create safekeeping places. Thank you. Questions?
What happened to the archival papers?
So we have scanned some of them. Uh-huh. And so there are a small portion in the archive. Like I said, we installed it in August 2007, and I was there for about 8 weeks, and we got about a little over 1,200 pieces of content in the archive. I trained two of the Warramunga women who work at the center, and I've recently spoken to them on the phone, and they said we're up to about 1,400, so they've been busy. The documents, I'd say there's, at this point, probably only makes up about 1% of it. People really want to get the photos in. And the documents we need to scan. So we got 700 pages, you know, back from the National Archives. Luckily, the archives have an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, so we didn't have to pay for any of that. They sent them back to the community free. And there's more. There's thousands of pages. And so they're just in files right now waiting to be scanned.
So do those same protocols get the paper?
Yes, and so they'll do the paper as well. So mainly that's going to be if there's, like, from anthropologists, if there's things about ceremonies. So far, the documents that we've put in that have been about the Phillip Creek Mission and Banka Banka Cattle Station, people are happy to have those open. Because they were just sort of describing, you know, what life was like and things like that. We haven't yet come across. There's one set of documents from Phillip Creek that I think will be dicey because there were several young Aboriginal girls who were sexually abused at the center. I mean, at the mission. And so my guess is those will be the documents that have to do with that. Those will probably be restricted. But so far, most of the documents we've put in haven't had very many restrictions. But they've been really sort of benign. You know, just, you know, so and so worked at the cattle stock. You know, or how much the government took. I mean, people were pretty incensed when you look at, because the government was making, you know, these payments to the cattle stations for their Aboriginal workers, and they didn't get paid. They got rations and blankets. So yeah. So.
Do you find that people are making use of the ability to add notes to the petition?
Yes, but not as much as we liked. So the next iteration of the archive that we're working on is going to have an external mic because people are not, even the people who are literate, they're not as comfortable. You know, they'll write really short, truncated types of things. But when you're talking to somebody, they'll give you this huge, long story. And so what we're going to do is there'll be an external mic that's hooked up. And so you, instead of type story, you'll click on record story. And then that'll get linked to the photo. It'll also get linked to that person's profile. So you'll have, you know, so Michael Jumbin has 20 stories that he's told. And you could look them up by place or something like that. Yeah.
Question, which was, I'm an artist, not an anthropologist, so it may be paternalistic and wrong way of thinking kind of question, but I see all the wonderful things that this does, and I wonder if there's any downside at all. Is there any way that you're changing the way that people think about, or the way that they organize, or the way that they care?
I don't think I am. I think that...
Right.
Obviously, we're going to have to wait into, you know, a few years to see. But one thing is, they're already changing all the time anyway, right? And so there's no static system that we're going in and interrupting, right? The system's been dynamic for the last 40,000 years. This is one layer that was added to it. The second thing is, because the archive was the idea of the community, so it wasn't, you know, a technologist dropped down and wants to work there for 6 months to get an Outback experience and is like, whoa, you guys should do this. It was the community saying, hey, we want to be able to see these photos, but right now we don't feel comfortable bringing in that old lady because she might see a picture of her son who died, and we don't want her to go through that trauma, right? And so... You know, for me, it was just, I'm no technologist. I was an anthropologist. Mine was just, okay, well, we should be able to do that, right? We should be able to take. The key is, it's an already existing social system that's dynamic. Now, you're absolutely right. The digital frame or whatever frame you're going to, just like when you write something, an oral tradition, which is what we had here that was written down, is going to change. The digital is certainly going to change it, but I don't think that that change should get incorporated into some sort of binary good, bad, right? I think that it will change it, and the question is going to be, what's that change going to look like? I think that because it was the community's choice that we're going to see some positive things. Like, kids already like to go and look at slideshows, and then they're going to go and talk to their grandparents and say, hey, I saw that of you and you were doing this, and what was that you were doing? Or, you know, we saw that bush banana. When can we go out and get bush bananas? Or how do you cook a bush banana, right? And so, particularly the town space, you know, is a space where, I mean, I can't predict the future, but I'm hopeful that because it came out of the community, that'll be something that they can dictate and decide how they want things to go. So.
Yeah, it seems like it might provide a reason to record that story,
right?
Or to reenact that dance,
yes,
and have it done on video or something like that, because
yes,
then you can put it in the archive,
right?
And so that people might reproduce their culture more for that reason.
No, and that is absolutely true. People have asked and said, you know, can you record this? Can you videotape this? The other thing that they put in was, there's a local rock band that calls themselves Jala Jirpa. Remember the White Cocky, and they they perform at a couple of the bars in town, and so we have videos of them in there, right? Because that's a cult that they're, you know, they didn't name themselves Jala Jirpa by accident. They are, it's a representation of themselves as people from this white cocky dreaming, but they also like to play rock music, and they've infused the two together. So, I mean, it'll be great. This we just installed in August of this last year. I'm going to go back this summer, and so it's going to be great over the next 2 or 3 years to see what happens, you know, how it gets used. So, did I see somebody else's hand?
So if I come in from Virginia, that's right. There, I'm already.
What do you get to see?
Yeah, well, where the one gentleman said, "Well, I can't even see this part that's my daughter's,
right,
or my wife's, or whatever." Is all of that close to me, or
yeah,
are there going to be things that I can see that he can't see?
No, anything that he could see, you could see. So the only things that, so right now, this is just in that community center space. The goal is to get a version of it put on a kiosk. So like when you go into some museums and they have kiosks on a screen in the front, in that gallery space, so that as you're looking at the artifacts and other things, you can, you know, do more and look at more. So, but that would be everything that would be marked open. And open means anybody in the Waramungu community can see it, and anybody else. So far, the things that have been marked open are pictures, let's say, of the telegraph station, some pictures of country that are pretty benign, that are, you know, not sacred sites, a lot of the documents. You're not going to, as of yet, see very many people. People are, that right now, that of the 1,200 or so images that I was present for when we were uploading them, I'd say 90 to 95% of the ones that were people were not open to be seen. But this is really interesting because the images that they got back from this missionary are things that you and I would think of in our family album. These are not, you know, these were really, and so people took, these are personal histories, and people didn't have photos of their grandparents, you know, they just did not have photos of themselves or their kin. And so these were, you know, these were things that people felt really strongly that they belonged to very specific families. And it would be like, you know, me just opening up my photo album and, you know, and having people look at it. And so because of the cultural protocols that were already in place alongside that history of dispossession and the stolen generation and everything else, it makes that even that much stronger, I think, that impulse. They could go back and change that. In 10 years, maybe 50% of the stuff will be open. You know what I mean? Maybe the next generation of kids that are then, you know, in 20 years, who are the ones that are managing, will say, you know, just like now, people will look at photos of people who have passed away. 15 years ago, that people weren't doing that. So maybe in another 20, you know, who knows how that will change. But as of now, it's, you know, a lot, most of that stuff is closed.
With things like children's dancing or something like that, would that...
Those would probably be open, yeah. Mm-hmm. And public performances. So when the train, there, you know, the new transcontinental train that goes from Adelaide to Darwin, when the train came through and it was named Pernu, which means carrier in Waramungu, and so they opened it and had a whole ceremony, and I took dozens of pictures that day. And, I mean, people were, you know, the women, they, these T-shirts are an adaptation, but the women had their, you know, were naked with their everything painted, the men, it was completely, you know, what you'd think of as traditional. And I said, what should we do with these? Oh, well, just make them open. Because it was this public performance, and all the white fellas saw it anyway. I mean, it wasn't anything that they didn't want people to see, because they already showed it to them. So those kinds of things will be in there as open. So, and you know, tourists will love that kind of stuff too. So,
could you explain those t-shirts?
Okay, so the t-shirts, I actually wrote a whole article about these t-shirts. So if you go to my blog under publications, so these t-shirts are an interesting story. Do it, you know, feel free if people need to leave. So the women, several of the women had performed in the Olympic opening ceremony in 2000. And had been to Sydney and met some people, and they had then started working with an ethnomusicologist from Sydney. And they created a CD, an international CD called Yawlya Mungamunga Women's Dreaming Songs, which you can buy on Amazon. So I encourage you, the profits will, part of the profits will go to those, these women. And so as part of that then, they went back to Sydney to work with this ethnomusicologist. To, once the CD came out, they were going to have this opening ceremony, right, in Sydney. Well, they got to Sydney. They couldn't get enough money for a lot of women to go. So only, it was either five women went. And so they got there, and they got there in the morning to the university, and Linda Barwick is her name. She sort of took them into the space that was open, and they started looking around, and it was just way too public, and they just felt really shame is what they'll say. Like, even though it's traditional and that's how they would dance, they just felt really kind of uptight. So Barwick, to her credit, okay, so Edith Nakamura, this woman here, she said, I've seen t-shirts when I went to Queensland of that Aboriginal women had done like this. So Linda Barwick went out and bought 5 black t-shirts and white paint and ochre paint, and they came back, and as the older women were singing in the background, singing the songs that you would paint when you paint, when you paint, put the paint on people's bodies, they sang the songs and painted the t-shirts. They used them then. This was in a performance as people were, this was in, 2002, when we were practicing for the ceremonies that were going to be on the, in Ninkanunu, there's a video screen that loops a bunch of different things, and one of the things is these performances. And the thing was, in the practice, they wore the t-shirts, but in the final one, they didn't. I never really got that. And I'm the anthropologist, and I was like, I'm not quite understanding this, but so these t-shirts are this wonderful adaptation that are used sometimes and put away other times, but the way that they were produced sort of still takes that traditional model. But what it's allowed is these young kids to get involved, because the teenage girls, there is no way they're going to perform bare-chested in any type of public space. So when they had the launch, so they had the first CD launch in Sydney. When they came back to Tennant Creek and had it in Tennant Creek, they really wanted to get the young girls involved, and they were having it in this. It's on the edge of town, but it's a very open public place. And the teenagers were like, because they go to high school with the white teenage boys, right? And they just were not going to do that. And so they bought 2 dozen more t-shirts. And again, the older women sang the songs just as they would have done if they were painting onto their bodies. And they... And so now it's been used sort of as this bridge to get these girls. And so what they're hoping is, going to get them in, because at least they're going to learn the songs and the dances. By the time they're in their 30s or 40s, hopefully some of that, sort of teenage angst and things will will have gone away. So yeah, they're a great story.
Is each woman wearing the t-shirt when it gets painted?
No, they were painted, just on the ground.
Black.
Yeah, to go with the ancestral tracks and stuff that they were singing. Yeah, these are Munga Munga songs that were all on there, and the Munga Munga tracks are really powerful through this area. They go quite far north, and the Warramunga women are known as bosses for quite a few of those songs. So they are really keen also to pass them on. So again, we've done recordings of them, and which are will be in the archive, aren't yet, but will be in the archive.
And so what's on the CD?
Munga Munga songs, yes. And again, there was a whole, whole negotiation process of what should go on that and not. So.
How do we find this on Amazon?
I'll give it to Margo, because YAW, forget. Yeah, you'll forget. But yeah, I'll give her the information and a link to the article that I wrote about it too. So yeah, do buy the CD though. It's fabulous.
Can I ask another ignorant question?
No ignorant questions. There's only questions.
Where do you see, as an anthropologist, where do you see, how much longer is the culture going to last?
Forever, right? Because it's dynamic.
These songs.
You mean how much longer is. Right. They're changing because they've been changing for 40,000 years. So what we know from anthropology books is that some, middle-aged old white guys wrote down, and now some, not quite middle-aged, white women are writing down, right? So it's a snapshot out of 40,000 years of tradition. And so I don't see this going away. It's going to change. There's going to be t-shirts and CDs, and there's going to be videos and DVDs, but they're still dancing and singing. There's going to be Jala Jirpa that's singing and rapping and talking about their country in a different way. That's not that much different than this, because they're articulating their relationships with each other and with places. That's what this is. And every articulation forges that link forward. So, you know, some anthropologists talk about the tracks of ancestors, and they use the metaphor of following, that people follow in their footsteps. And one of the arguments that I made in my dissertation was that they do follow. You do follow the tracks of the ancestors, but you also forge new tracks. And that's what the cultural center is. That's what the archive is. That's what the t-shirts are. You know, it's not all light and, you know, cheery and roses. Of course, you know, there's high unemployment and there's alcoholism and there's all these things. But amongst that, there's also these t-shirts and the CD and everything else. So, you know, I think it's going to go on as long as there are Warmongoo people.
And are the rocks still there? Or did they break the center was?
No, they're, yeah, so the rocks are there at one end of the center, and then the building's over here. Yeah.
She sort of touched on one thing. When you were talking about the archive and how it changes, people can go in
right.
Notes and everything. And I was thinking at the time, well, is it being saved the way it is before someone comes in and makes a change to it?
Well, right. So
like a history.
You know, yeah. So the first.
What was originally there.
Right. So the in that first commentary box when you upload it, that stays, and then maybe I go in, add my comment, that stays. Every comment just layers, so nothing ever gets replaced. Exactly. Nothing ever gets, it's like a blog. If you look at a blog, everybody adds a comment. You can delete something from a blog, but we're not deleting anything. So, the comments are just layered, and they're also there's a time stamp and a date stamp, so we know you said that on August 5th, 2008. And so it's, actually helps with that record. Well, we hope. I hope. I mean, that's.
So.
But you can go look at a demo of the archive, and I'm sure Margo will put this up on the website as well. Obviously, there's nothing in there from Tennant Creek, but you can go ahead and give yourself a user profile to see how it works. Upload some of your photos, do protocols on them. You know, you can test it out. It's just to give people an idea. There's no Warmongoo content on there. So far, it's mostly just pictures of my kids, their backs. So I try to find all pictures.
Oh,
well, thank you.
Starting out to figure out how to do that.
You know, it's good technologists, and this is one of the things, that I've learned about collaboration is that, and I learned it from working in Tennant Creek. And this project is all about, the only way you can forge new tracks is if you get all the different groups of people together to do the dance, because nobody knows it all. Right? And they have to come together to forge that new track. Well, I don't know how to code. I don't know how to write code. I'm not a graphic designer. But there's people out there who are those things who were wonderful. And Craig Dietrich and Tim Dietrich and Chris Cooney, who worked on this, and all the Warmongoo people every time I went back and forth trying to get it right. So it's a testament to that, I think.
Is there, or would you consider putting in any geographic information where photos were taken?
Yes, so there is. So right now you put the location where it was taken, but the next iteration of the archive, we're hoping to have a dynamic map, kind of like Google Maps. We just ran out of time and money for this one, but so it would be, you would have this dance and you'd say, this is at Kunjara, so you'd mark Kunjara on the map, and then one of the ways you could search was by, exactly, yeah. So the technology now is out there for us to do, actually, because what's great about Google Maps now, you can embed that in anything, and so, yeah, and so we're working on that, yeah. Because, place is so important. Right now, we just have it static. It's just named. It'd be great because then you could probably get, would be great to then see those, right, connected. So if you saw all the dances that were associated or something. So, there's some great possibilities with the mapping.
Put in, replace the sort of satellite photo.
Right.
With
yes.
A map of their land.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you had that sort of just baseline topography, then you would be doing it. Yeah, I think that's going to be great once we can do that.
Okay. I know there are probably more questions, but you can talk to Kim at the reception that we'll have now. And I just want to give her a couple of things from Kluge Roo.
Oh, thank you.
And also is the traditional Kluge Roo gift to anybody who's worked in the bush. It's a UVA panicker.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Virginia UVA Cavaliers.
All right.
Anyway.
Great.
And thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks.